Hi, and welcome back to Apology, a podcast about books and reading. Today's guest is the writer Nomi Fry. Nomi is a staffer at The New Yorker, where she covers popular culture, books, art, and sometimes news. Her recent pieces are about things like the HBO series Euphoria and Succession, Kanye West's love life, a new book by the photographer Daniel Arnold, the trial of Ghislaine Maxwell. Nomi writes about all this stuff with a sort of leveling intelligence. She doesn't make much of a distinction between so-called low and so-called high culture. She treats everything with wit and even a kind of respect. Nomi is also a recovering literary academic, having studied humanities at the University of Tel Aviv. She's from Israel and now lives in New York. And she has a master's in English from Johns Hopkins. So there are plenty of good recommendations in this episode, which we will get into right now. So what are you reading right now?
What am I reading? I'm reading a book that I picked up at like a sort of a charity shop upstate like a couple of weeks ago. Martin Amis's Money, which I've never read, even though it's from 1984. And, you know, there's like no real reason to read it right now. I just like randomly picked it up and I was like, you know, I collect so many books. When I say collect, I don't mean like in any way rare books or value, but I can't help but just like pick up books wherever I go. Like if I'm walking down the street in Bed-Stuy where I live, and I just, you know, people often put out books.
Yeah.
And I'll just take, sometimes it might be a book I have. I mean, that's pretty rare, but if it's like an edition I like or something,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's very hard for me to resist not picking up books. Even if I don't know, or buying books, or yeah. Even if I don't exactly know when I'm going to read them or if I'll ever read them. So
yeah.
This is the case. I was just like upstate over Christmas, and it was a little depressing. Like I was supposed to go to Israel to visit my family, and I ended up not going because of COVID complications. And so
right.
We ended up just going upstate without any real plan, just like getting an Airbnb. And it was you know, a little depressing. Like the weather was kind of rainy and cold, and like everything was closed, including all the, you know, whatever bookstores, like Book Barns or whatever else that I would usually enjoy visiting.
It's like half the reason to go upstate is places like
that. Exactly. Like what other reason is there, basically? But then we passed by, you know, we were just like driving down this like completely dead, like tiny town. And suddenly there was like this store, this thrift store, charity store open. And we walked in and they had books in there, and they were just like, oh, you just like, you can just take them for free. I mean, you can donate whatever you want, but
oh,
it
wow.
was just, yeah, it was weird. And so I picked up, I picked up. And there weren't even that many books. One of them was Money, the Martin Amis book. There was the Larry Sanders autobiography.
Right, know,
like,
yeah.
Joke autobiography, like as told to whoever, you know, the ghostwriter was.
Right.
And like a sort of like a kind of pulpy memoir from the 80s. That's like the story of the Mayflower Madam, which a friend had told me about. So I picked up all three of those, not intending to read any of them anytime soon, you know. And then when we got home, I had finished a book I was reading before, and I was like, I picked up the Martin Amis. I was actually all ready to go in to read the new Franzen, which my husband had just finally finished.
Yeah.
But then I picked up the Martin Amis, and I was like, why don't I read like this Martin Amis novel from like 1984, you know? So that's it. So I'm nearing the end of that right now. And it's really good. I'm very impressed with you, Martin Amis.
If you're listening.
If you're listening.
I've only read by him. I read London Fields because I remember in like in the Face or Select magazine or something like that in the early 90s, Damon Albarn from Blur said that he loved London Fields.
Oh, that's really funny. Had I read that, then I would have also picked that up. I'd only ever read the Rachel papers, from Martin Amis, which also remember there was a movie. And I remember watching the movie when I was like probably 10 or something and feeling very embarrassed because it was like Ione Skye. It was like a American girl and like a British boy. And Ione Skye was the American girl in the movie. And it was kind of like it was probably inappropriate for the age I watched it in. Maybe I wasn't 10. Maybe I was like actually in puberty. I was maybe like 13 or something, but it was very off-putting to me. And then years later, I read the novel. But then apart from that, I hadn't read any Martin Amis. So
what's Money about? Is it about, I guess over in London, they call them city boys. Wall Street guys are called city boys.
Yeah. So it's actually not about that, surprisingly. It's about a guy who is kind of like a vulgar oaf. Kind of, but he's also obviously, you know, he has some sensitivity and, you know, some self-doubt and all of that, but he's basically kind of like the embodiment of it. He's like an alcoholic. He's like, you know, was very into like porn, you know, sex with prostitutes. He hits women, you know, he's like he's a kind of an unsavory character. And
yeah,
he made his money by doing these like, this is kind of like the backstory of the novel, by doing these vulgar sort of like early Thatcher Britain commercials, you know, just sort of like the entree of like neoliberalism into England. And you sort of the fading of the kind of welfare state, you know, and he's kind of part of that. And now as the movie begins, he's working for the first time on directing a movie called Bad Money. The movie is called Bad Money.
Okay.
And it's a kind of like pulpy sort of action thing. And he, for the entirety of the book, he is between London and New York, just sort of trying to make this movie happen. And it's basically about, it's a very relevant and contemporary book because it's about the kind of like the vulgarity of money and how it rules absolutely everything, you know,
how
all of these appetites that people have that are kind of poisonous, these kind of like voracious appetites for sex and, you know, food and drugs and alcohol are all animated by the, you know, culture that we're constantly kind of like immersed in. I don't know how enticing I'm making the sound, but it's like really funny. And it's like, absolutely. I was thinking there was like the way he uses language. What was it? Oh yeah. He was talking about how he was like the protagonist was it's first person. He was talking about how he was rooting in the trash for something. I don't remember what it was. I just was reading it last night. And he didn't say rooting. He said rootling. There I was rootling around, you know, in the garbage pail. And I was just thinking, oh, that's such a great... just like flourishes like that, which, I'm just really enjoying. It's like very funny. And it's not... I was worried that it was too... It was going to be too sort of like 80s postmodern, you know,
because
there are sort of like elements of it. Like at one point, Martin Amis himself becomes a character, like a very modern character, but he kind of enters the novel as kind of like he does script doctoring for this guy. So there are elements that are kind of in that way postmodern. And definitely it's like very sort of like overstuffed and you know, sort of a maximalist in the way these novels were, but it's a sort of, I need something to ultimately be grounded in realism to really enjoy it. And it's enough of that, that I, you know, enjoying it and I'm satisfied with it. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So I definitely, I'm like, you know, I have like, I don't know, like 50 pages to go still, I guess. But yeah, so that will be my first book of the year, I guess.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I finished another book just before, and maybe that entered into the new year, but I don't consider that my first. This is my first full book of the year.
Okay. What was the other one that you finished?
The other book was that Zola book, which made you, because I was like tweeting about it, I think.
Right.
I was
like, yeah.
And yeah, Zola's The Kill, which I also, you know, ended up handily using in this thing I wrote about Ghislaine Maxwell after her verdict, because as I was reading it and I was also kind of like reporting a little from the trial, I was like, oh, this is really apropos.
How so?
Well, I think the book is from 1872, but it's set slightly earlier, like in the early, I think in the early 60s maybe, and it's like you know, the Second Empire, like the backdrop is like Paris is being remade.
Right.
And you know, it's the rise of the money men and the rise of like real estate speculation. And so kind of on the background of that, there's like this character of a very kind of shiesty speculator. And he marries, and very underhanded and very sort of like Epstein-esque in the sense of like, who knows where the money comes from exactly? You know, it's sort of like,
right,
an untold riches, but it could all collapse at any moment. And it's not totally clear if there's any ground to it at all. And it's all kind of like mysterious dealings and lies and so on. And he marries this very young, beautiful woman, who then ends up carrying on an affair with his son from his previous marriage.
Okay.
So it's this sort of like sexual intrigue, kind of like sort of fucked up perverse family structure, you know, and all
very French novel.
Yeah, yeah, very French, and all with the backdrop of kind of like, you know, speculation, luxury, kind of just absolute waste, you know,
right.
Kind of like and decadence. So it was just as I was reading it, and I was like, at the same time, kind of, I went to the trial, but I also mostly read the, at the end of every day, I would get the transcripts from the trial. So I was like, you know, reading that and reading the Zola novel. And I was like, oh, okay, I can see. It's just kind of interesting in the same way that the Martin Amis now. I mean, I guess I also have like pretty particular tastes in what I choose to read, but
yeah,
it's there's a lot that, you know, you read stuff and you're like, oh yeah, that, you know, it was like 1860, but it's not, obviously a lot of things are different, but a lot of things are pretty much the same.
Well, especially issues of power imbalance,
right? Exactly. So, which I always find interesting. So I guess like my kind of my eye pretty consistently turns to that.
I actually have never read Zola. What's his tone like? Is he funny? Is he serious?
Not really funny. No. Of course he's written like 70 novels or something. I mean, I don't know how many, like a lot, but
yeah,
read maybe, I want to say I've read 4 or 5 probably. And in my, so I don't know, you know, but I don't think, no, not funny. No, like really dead serious.
Okay.
and pretty kind of like plotting, you know, it's naturalism, so it's descriptive. This one was pretty melodramatic, like sort of pretty Baroque, you know, and just kind of like the repetitive description, and the kind of, the story is obviously very kind of like Greek tragedy.
Uh-huh.
So it's kind of overwrought, I guess. And it's always about, like, you know, how terrible society is.
Uh-huh.
You know, and how venal people are, and kind of their dark impulses, and how that often comes to play out in the modern world, you know, with its temptations, yeah, and, like, you know, that sort of thing.
It sounds like there's some overlap with the Amos book thematically. Yeah. Is this the kind of thing that you're drawn to, do you think?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, not just, but definitely. Not because that's the kind of life I lead, but it's the kind of thing that always interests me to look to, you know, and the things I write about as well. Like, I also write about, like, you know, reality television, or I write about, you know, it's like these kind of, like, I guess, pathologies that emerge from a kind of, like, I guess the pathologies that emerge from capitalism, I guess that's kind,
yeah,
of a very broad way of saying it, but
yeah,
you know what I mean? So, definitely those are themes that I'm drawn to, whether in what I read or, like, what I write about, the stuff that I enjoy observing, either for, like, pleasure, you know?
Yeah.
If I read the, like, Daily Mail or whatever, just watch reality television for fun. But then also the stuff that's fodder for me to think about a little bit more deeply for my work. And that I'm kind of, like, repelled by, but also drawn to, you know?
Yeah, what is that? That it's so interesting. There's kind of a masochistic urge for me in watching some reality TV or reading trash journalism, like, you know, Us Weekly or something like that.
Right. I don't know. I've always really enjoyed it. It's just, like, so endlessly interesting to me. I mean, I don't know if endlessly, but it's interesting to me because I feel like it's so different from the way I grew up and the way I think about life, and I think about relationships between people. And, you know, if I see a kind of, like, you know, if I'm interested in reading, say, a book like this Zola book, right, which is about kind of, like, relationships that are based almost purely on power, right, rather than on fellow feeling or sympathy or interest, even, you know, and it's just very different from the way that I think about the world. And so, of course, like, it repels me in some ways, but it's also, I almost envy it, I guess, in some way, or it attracts me, or I'm like, I think about it kind of, like, hypothetically, like, how would it be to survive in the world like that? And I feel very outside of it. And I, in some ways, of course, it's very lucky to be outside of it, but in other ways, I'm also, like, always wondering whether I could kind of, I have, I think, probably, like, a secret desire of, like, wow, what if I could, like, actually hack it in a world like that? That's built on, like, completely, you know, like, surface interactions or something, which is, you know, you always ask me, like, why I'm attracted to Los Angeles, and there's, you know, there's something in that there, right? Because I feel so different from it. I feel like a total outsider. Of course, Los Angeles is a million things, you know, it's not, it could be, like, I'm talking more about the mythology of Los Angeles rather than the actual, like, lived experience, you know, but, you know, I'm attracted to being a kind of like a stealth, a spy in the house of,
a spy in the house of status and power.
Right.
Obsessed people.
Yeah.
It seems like your LA experience when you come here is really interesting because you have, like, your friends, and you have some mutual friends here who are, like, very down to earth, great people, but then you're often here to report on something that's in this rarefied air.
Right.
You kind of are living between these two worlds.
Yeah. And being, I guess, being a writer is something, a reader and a writer, you know, a reader in my time, you know, in my pleasure time or my, you know, but edification time, and a writer in my work time, you know, is kind of allows me to straddle that, you know, and allows me kind of entree into that sort of world that I feel like almost like preemptively rejected by it.
Mm. Yeah.
And even though it doesn't seem, you know, when you really get into it, it doesn't really seem like a club you would want to be accepted into necessarily, because it's kind of like a fair weather club, right? Like,
yeah.
it's not something that is built, it's speculation, right? It's not something that's built on any lasting feelings or attributes, you know? I don't know. I just think it's something that I probably grew up feeling like an outsider in some ways, and that has persisted. And, you know, probably a lot of people that either know me or know like what I do or whatever, like the circles I move in, would say like, you live in New York and you know a bunch of people. Like, it's not like I'm like writing from the farm, you know?
No, I mean? Yeah. But you can, you can feel like an outsider inside. You can feel like an outsider inside no matter what you're doing.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I think that's true, right? I think
a lot of writers do.
Yeah. And I think that's just like my consistent stance, you know?
Yeah.
And I identify with outsiders, and I'm like, you know, both repelled by and attracted to what I perceive as insiders, even though those insiders might also think of themselves or feel deep down that they're outsiders.
Find me a person who doesn't have imposter syndrome to some degree.
I mean, I hope so.
Yeah. I'm curious to know, like, if you can remember, when did you find this sort of mix of writing that you do, which is treating sometimes these very popular culture things with a high-minded approach? Like, when did that start for you?
Well, I mean, before I was a professional writer, way before, I was an aspiring academic. And I went to... I was doing a PhD. That's the reason I actually came to America from Israel. Like, I mean, this was like almost 20 years ago, but I came to do grad school in at Johns Hopkins to do an English PhD. And I ended up getting a master's and then trying to start writing my dissertation and not finishing. Like, I left. Mm. So I have my master's, but I don't have a PhD. And then sort of moving to New York and little by little, like over the course of years, starting to write. And, you know, and so I would say it's a couple things. You know, I went to college in the late 90s, early 2000s. And that as you know, because we're about the same age, the kind of the heyday of kind of cultural studies.
Oh, yes.
And the understanding, the sudden understanding that like, oh, you can analyze this like piece of gum wrap, you know, wrapper. And
yeah, anything is ripe for it. Yeah.
Everything is a text, you know, and I think that obviously was not just for me, but I think in general, the sort of like, approach of kind of like being like a reader of modern life and gleaning meaning from everything that you enjoy anyway, you know?
Yeah.
You need to be, I think that was, you know, really influential just in general on the culture and people our age and kind of.
It was a big moment. Yeah, it was definitely a big moment.
Yeah. So I think that kind of was an early example of like, oh, you can analyze an advertising in a magazine. You know, like I totally remember being in college and being like, oh, you know, like the things that I'm looking at and thinking about and being like a critical person and being kind of like snarky anyway and coming from a kind of like negative negative attitude. And you know, and just like being kind of like Gen X, like suspicious culture, you know,
Adbusters,
you know, just the sort of like, and just generally in academia as well, kind of like a suspicious reading, an approach to critical approach to popular culture. I think a lot of it came initially from academia for a lot of people.
Who were some of the writers that, I mean, the first thing I think of when I think about analyzing so-called low culture, in a cultural studies kind of way is Roland Barthes, Mythologies.
Yeah, right? Totally. I mean, just like your basic, even your basic course, theory course, you know, like theory 101 that starts with like structuralism, you know, and just like the idea of like sign and signify, you know, like signifier and signified. And, you know, moving from that to like, I mean, obviously I think the most influential for me, and that was something that later and I would say probably in undergrad, it was like, you know, I took a lot of women's studies courses and, you know, and obviously it's just sort of like Butler and, you know, all of those like very 90s.
Judith Butler, Richard Dyer, people like that.
Yeah. You know, subculture, the meaning of style, like the cabbage, you know, structuralism, you know, broadly structuralism based and post-structuralism based, popular culture analysis. And I think then, especially in grad school, like the Marxist critics were very important for me, you know, whether it's like, you know, I mean, Marx himself or Lukács or like, you know, Frankfurt School, like
Adorno and Horkheimer.
Horkheimer, like, you know, Marcuse, like, you know, there was that book, like Aesthetics and Politics, that had like conversations or letters, I guess, between like different Marxist, like, you know, broadly Frankfurt Schoolish, writers. I'm trying to remember. It had like Adorno, Horkheimer. I think it had Althusser and had Lukács and had Ernst Bloch, I think.
I don't know that one. And it was correspondence between the different writers?
I don't know if it's actual course. Like, I don't remember if it was like literally letters they wrote each other, if it was just like letters they published and it was like in response to like, you know, my friend and colleague X. Like, it might be a combination, but it's a collection.
Yeah.
And they all center on aesthetics and politics, you know, on the trouble of aesthetics and politics, the problem of aesthetics and politics, you know, so I remember that was something that I really liked. I had a professor in grad school, was actually like a Renaissance scholar, but he was also a Marxist critic, Richard Halpern. And that was a class he taught about like aesthetics and politics. And it was very like, you know, influential for me.
What a mix, Renaissance and Marxism.
Yeah. I never took a Renaissance class with him because I never did any Renaissance. I never had any interest. Like my interest, I mean, pretty much starts with the 19th century, I think always has. Like maybe some 18th century, like maybe or like late 18th century, early 19th, like Romantics, you know. Like,
yeah, the Romantics, yeah.
But for me, it starts with, I mean, obviously capitalism started, you know, but the sort of like advancement of capitalism in the 19th century. I think that was always what kind of like piqued my interest, you know, where things became like sexy for me, you know, I mean, you know what I mean? Like just interesting intellectually.
That, I mean, there is something, sort of like,
really just, I was like, I mean, in novels too, like I read, you know, I took a class, I took, when I did my oral exams to get my master, I had like two concentrations. One had to be genre and the other had to be historical. So for the genre, I did the novel, like you could do poetry or you could do theory. I did the novel, and then my historical concentration was Victorian, which would have been my field had I, you know, completed my dissertation. So for the novel concentration, I read a bunch of like 18th century novels, you know, like from like Moll Flanders and like, you know, Pamela and, you know, Robinson Crusoe and Evelina and, you know, like all of those books. But it's somehow I never super took to the 18th century. Like for me, the 19th century is where it started getting interesting. No offense.
No offense, 18th century. No shade.
Sorry, this is long-winded. How did I become interested in the sort of intersection between popular culture and writing? So I think academia was definitely like the way things were thought about. I don't know how they're thought about now. I really don't know. It's become so like Byzantine to me, like, because I'm completely out of it. It's so Baroque, like what is now in fashion, and I have no idea because it's so kind of internal, you know, have no connection to it really. So I have no idea what people are doing now, but at the time as an undergrad, it was, you know, very important to me. And then when I started writing, it was always for me, I always loved both, you know, I loved like 19th century novels, and I always, you know, I was always interested in, like, I loved school, you know, it wasn't like, I was just like, oh, like, let me just watch reality television. Like I was always interested in acquiring academic tools and acquiring like, you know, canonical knowledge. Like that was really just like very basically important to me, not necessarily as a project of self-improvement, but just because, I mean, I really remember like being an undergrad and getting like the book list for a course and being like, oh, like, what are we going to read?
This is exciting.
So exciting. And like going to the bookstore and like buying all the books.
Yeah.
Class and having them like, you know, oh yay, we're going to read like Middlemarch, you know, like, or whatever. So I was always that, but I always really enjoyed garbage as well. And just like, loved having that be part of my life and knowing a lot of details about that kind of thing, whether it's like, you know, celebrity gossip or whether it's like, I mean, when I was younger, it was music, you know, when I was like a teenager, and then, you know, just like always reading like celebrity memoirs and like, watching later on it was reality television and you know, for me it also had to do with, and these things were often American and for me, you know, because I'm Israeli and when I was a child I spent time in the States because my dad worked here, but sort of off and on and mostly in Israel, like and then I as an adult, like a, you know, in my early 20s, I came to the States like without my parents, you know, without my birth family. And then I stayed here. But for me, America was always the kind of place where everything was going on. You know, I was very attracted to it. And so I think my love of kind of popular culture attached to that as well was connected to that and to a kind of like yearning, especially in kind of the pre-internet days, you know, in the 90s, like, because everything was so hard to get. And so every little piece of it was savored when you could get it, when you could get like a magazine, when you could get like a new album or an old album, I mean, or a t-shirt or whatever it is, like everything was so much more difficult. And so kind of cathecting on these like pieces of culture, popular culture, became really important. And I think in a way that it's important to a lot of kids, you know, and in general, certainly then, you know, and maybe doubly so when you're like a foreigner, you know, who's kind of like,
yeah,
what's this experience from other like immigrants, you know?
It's part of how you construct your identity, your consumption of culture, right?
Yeah. And so I think it had to do with that. And I don't know. It's always surprising to me that not everyone feels this way, that kind of like this combination of like a kind of more analytical or a more kind of like canonically informed perspective and then the kind of things that are considered more reduced. Obviously, there's a lot of that. I'm not saying there's a ton of, you know, writing intelligently about popular culture, kind of like thinking about.
Yeah.
But I guess I'm surprised that not everybody wants to do it. I guess, you know, different things are interesting. I mean, for instance, like my husband could care less about reality television, say, you know, like,
right.
To him, it's, or celebrity gossip. To me, it's like endlessly interesting, you know? And I wouldn't mind like thinking about it, which I kind of do in a way, you know, thinking about it a lot.
Yeah. I mean, you can think about celebrity gossip as one big 19th century novel in a way.
Totally. Yeah. Of course. It's not detached from it. There's a lot of similarities for sure.
Were there specific writers outside of academia who were inspiring to you in this kind of realm?
You know, I wasn't. I think maybe it was because I wasn't in America, you know, until I was in my 20s. I mean, I definitely read, like my parents were very sort of outward facing, like America facing, I guess, foremost. So they like subscribed to The New Yorker and they subscribed to Harper's, you know, like we were kind of, you know, I mean, my parents are both academics. And so I was definitely familiar, you know, like I remember reading like the Jay McInerney, like Chloe 70
right.
profile, like when it came out, you know, which was right. like whatever, 94 or something like that, I think.
Yeah.
When I was still in Israel then, I was like 18. Like, and I remember reading it and being like, okay, this is the best thing I've ever read. Like, this is so interesting. This is so amazing.
Yeah.
Like it just describes this world. Or like, you know, I subscribed to Sassy, you know, when I was like
sure.
in high school. And that was like incredibly important to me, like incredibly, because it created, you know, as a lot of other women my age would tell you, you know, because it created this sense of like, oh, you know, there's a world beyond. These are like, they're writers and they're living in New York and
yeah,
like fun and, you know, and it's like they're interested in like, you know, and this was the period where there was still so much difference between kind of like mainstream culture and alternative culture, you know, all the things that are very obvious to us.
Yeah.
People who went through the whole shift, things are very different now, obviously. But, you know, the kind of separation between culture and subculture was very pronounced then. So,
yeah, very clear, very clear.
It was, you know, the things that I read, the kind of music I listened to, obviously, like everyone I'm friends with now who's about my age was like had exactly the same trajectory. It wasn't that special, but I think, you know, when you're young, it like instills in you this sort of feeling like, oh yeah, I read the like the Chloe 70 profile in the New Yorker, you know. Especially living in Israel, that really meant something to me, you know?
It's a seminal piece.
It's, yeah. And, you know, when I did a talk of the town with Chloe, like, I don't know, maybe a year and a half ago or something, I was like, oh, wow, I'm like, this is kind of like historic for me. Like, you know,
sure.
that I'm I mean, obviously it's not the same thing and things are completely different and it's not a, but I was like, oh, I guess I'm like writing about Chloe having a baby in the New Yorker. Like, this is kind of crazy. Like,
yeah.
Which I'm sure everybody who's written about Chloe has felt kind of like a version of that, you know, if they were like coming from the perspective of like, oh my God, I read this when I was a teenager. And like,
yeah, it's interesting.
Cool, famous thing in the world, you know?
So much, it's a big part of the story of her fame is this McInerney story. It's really kind of like the origin.
Yeah.
I don't know if there are many other people who have something like that.
Yeah. I mean, the thing was, I knew who she was because of Sassy.
Right.
You know, because I had pored over Sassy like crazy.
Something Sassy did so well was make you feel that you knew the personalities behind the magazine.
I mean, that it was proto blog, you know, it was really, really influential. Like, you know, in that way, like Jane Pratt was really a genius. Like, it was kind of amazing. Like, nothing. It was like nothing else was like that, I don't think, at the time. And then it became obviously that, you know, kind of directly or indirectly spawned an entire culture that became the kind of like so depressing, you know, sort of like, you know, confessional, like Exo Jane.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
Kind of. Yeah. I mean, it's so dark.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
so dark. It's depressing. But I guess everything is like that. I guess kind of. I don't know. Everything is like a hustle, you know? Like everything needs to. I guess the only way not to hustle is to sort of have family money, maybe, you know, to not have to be part of. To an extent.
Okay. Even those people need to hustle to sort of create some kind of an identity, though.
That's true. When sometimes you see people on Instagram and you're like, okay, except for being independently wealthy, what is it that you do exactly? Oh, you have like a company for handbags or something. You
right.
know, something
right.
fake.
Right.
That's clearly just like an identity proper, you know, proper upper.
Proper upper.
Yeah. I don't know why we're talking about this, but anyway, yeah. Oh, so to the question of who I read, I mean, I can't really say, like, I think I mostly read fiction, honestly.
Mm.
Like I mostly, like as a kid or like as a, you know, whatever, teen or like in my 20s. And yeah, so I didn't really have an idea. I mean, you know, I remember like iconic stories from the New Yorker. Like I remember the Daphne Merkin spanking story. I remember, do you remember that?
No. What was that about? No.
It was like, this was maybe, I want to say it was like 96. No, maybe 97 or something. Daphne Merkin wrote a story in the New Yorker, which was about how. And it was like, you know, it was like a personal history, but like in the print magazine, obviously in the print, there wasn't a website then, I don't think, about her fantasies and like practice of spanking.
Oh, okay.
And I remember reading it and being like, wow, this is like crazy, you know, because that combination of kind of like a very, you know, like staid New Yorker, you know, the New Yorker font and...
Right.
And then like reading that, it just felt kind of, I remember thinking, oh, this is sort of cool, you know, feeling sort of intimidated and like, but I remember I was still in Israel. I remember reading it like, I don't know. I just remember these like, discrete things that I read and I was like, oh wow, these people are like living in New York or like, you know, obviously I read The Face in the 90s, you know, all of those things.
We touched on in a DM conversation a long time ago, maybe like a year and a half ago. We talked about that era of details, that like James Truman details era.
Yeah, I totally remember like James Truman's details. I remember the first time I read it, I had a friend, like this was in Israel. I was in high school. I had a friend whose sister married an American, a guy who was in the Navy. And he moved to Israel to be with her or something. And he was, he subscribed to Details. And this was like 90, three.
Oh, that's that's the era. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So I remember reading his discarded details. This was how complicated things were then, right? Like you would have to have some sort of like, I mean, especially outside of America, you know, you had to have some sort of like weird, I mean, if you're lucky enough to like be in a family that subscribed to something, it's not that it was impossible, but it was fairly rare. And then when it like the more somewhat more obscure things, it was just like a weird happenstance how you got to them.
Yeah.
You but to I find- totally remember being like fascinated and impressed by it, by like the, you know, sort of like immersive journalism and, you know, just like, wow, what's happening? It's crazy. Totally.
You mentioned before we started recording that you kept a reading list last year for the first time ever. What did you like? How'd that work? And like, what'd you learn about yourself and your habits from doing it?
Felt like it was kind of useful. Like I, you know, I always want to read more. I used to read so much, obviously before the advent of the iPhone and, you know, becoming in social media, obviously, and becoming addicted to it.
Yeah.
I feel like I used to just like read way more. I mean, probably we all did, I would imagine, you know, when that was, and then obviously it's my reading has been affected also just by having a child and having a job and you know all this and watching reality television, you know, there a lot of things have come to replace my reading of like, you know, I remember like reading like Vanity Fair, you know, not the magazine. I mean, also the magazine, but like, you know, reading the novel. And it's like, I was like, oh, I miss those days. Like, you know, when I was like 20 or whatever, like 25, like, why am I not like fucking reading like, you know, Daniel Deronda or something. So, but then on the other hand, I don't want to make my life into like a project, you know, I mean, life is hard enough. So I saw people, you know, at the end of last year, I remember seeing, or at the end of the year before, at the end of 2020, I remember seeing people like posting, these are the books that I read this year, whatever. And while I wasn't necessarily attracted to sharing that, I was like, oh, that's maybe a good idea to sort of like not tally exactly, but just to know what you read and remind yourself after. And because the other thing is like when people ask me, you know, a couple times a year, the New Yorker, like the website does roundups, like asks staffers to write like a paragraph about like a book they read this year, you know, or whatever, like in the summer, like what are we reading for summer? What have we read like this past fall or whatever? And I'm always like, what's a book? You know, I can't remember a single book. Obviously I did read books, but I'm like, what did I read? You know, like,
I
have no idea. I can't remember. Did I read it this year? Like what happened? Was this, oh no, that was 4 years ago, you know, whatever. And so I was like, oh, so that'll solve that, you know? And I ended up doing it. And now it's very satisfying to look back because now I know what I read.
Did you just make a list or did you write down notes?
No notes. And another thing that I like about it, and this is kind of the thing of like picking up the Martin Amis, you know, randomly, you know, one thing I hate and like I feel have no respect towards, or not respect, I mean, I have plenty of respect for anyone who whatever does what they want to do. Like, it's fine. I'm not really judging, but it's, I'll just say that it's surprising to me when people emphasize what they read in the past year that was published this year.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, why? Like, why would you read? I mean, I'm not saying that I won't read. Like, I read this. I too read the Sally Rooney book, and I too read the Franz. And like, I'm not against obviously reading contemporary whatever you want that just came out and looks interesting and relevant to your interests and like important to read. But just people who like seem to kind of want to mostly or only read books that came out this year. Like it's a, I just, like a
zeitgeisty kind of urge.
Yeah. Or I don't know why that it would even be like that. They would read books that they like, there's so many books to read, you know? Yeah. And it's kind of like half the fun is just like either picking something up, like going to the shelf. I mean, I have so many books that I haven't read, you know, I mean, I have a lot of books that I have read, but a lot of books that are just that, like I said, I just picked up or bought or whatever over the years, like, or that I get sent, you know, now. And it's fun to just like shop your own shelf.
It's the best. Yeah.
And randomly, you know, I have so many New York Review of Books classics books.
Yeah, that's a great series.
And that I've read some of them, and so many of them I haven't. Either I picked them up or I got sent them or something. And you know it's going to be good. You know what I mean? Like, you know that you're going to read something, and it might be something about, like, the Anglo-Irish aristocracy in the 1920s, or it might be something about, like, the Warsaw Ghetto, or it might be something about... You know, it might be like about an Italian, you know, it might be like a Maupassant or something, or it might be, you know, it could be like a lot of different things, but you know, it's most likely going to be like really good. And it's just so fun and random to just like pick something up and read. And then when I'm asked to like recommend something, I can always say, oh, you know what I read this year? I read, you know, X, you know. And this has some like trash on it. Like it has like, if I'm looking at the list, it has like the Hunter Biden memoir that I thought I would write up.
How was that?
It was disappointing.
Really? I figured it would have been.
It's disappointing because he doesn't, there's no juice.
Come on. It was probably very, very micromanaged by the family. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't blame him, but it was to the reader, to myself as the reader, it was disappointing. Yeah. But like I read some of the books that I read this year were like amazing that I'd never read before. Like I read like Nabokov's Laughter in the Dark, and I was like, how have I not read this? It's like absolutely incredible, you know?
Yeah.
What else did I read that was like amazing? Let's see. I mean, I love the Tarantino, like that is a book that came out last year, but like the novelization.
The novelization. Yeah.
That's really good.
I struggled with it. Yeah. I struggled with it.
What were your feelings?
I talked about this on a previous episode with the film critic, A.S. Hamra. We kind of felt the same way. It felt like it was Tarantino's sort of background work for the film that didn't necessarily need to be seen.
Yeah.
Like it was research, it was background on characters, it was background on setting. And so I enjoyed it because I'm a nerd for film like that, but I think on a writing level I didn't think he was very good. I think there was a lot of like, you know, the old rule, and I think it goes back to Strunk and White. It's like when somebody says something, just they said.
Oh yeah, but I love that. Did I talk to you about this?
We got into it a little bit, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like I mentioned this to someone, or maybe it was to more than one person, that I loved how corny, how badly written it was. Like it might not have been intentional. I don't know, but it just like to me, it was a perfect mimicking of these kind of like pulpy, you know, paperbacks where it's really not very well written, but it has like a wealth of like a world, you know.
It has a lot of energy too. Yeah.
And so much energy. And I mean, I can't say that I remember many details from it, you know, because it's so like gets in the weeds with like, he was replaced by, you know,
yeah, like
Bridges in the second role after coming out of like, you know, doing like the third season of Gunsmoke, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
So, but I don't know. I loved it. But I also loved the movie. So like, you know, for me, it was just like, oh yeah, yeah. I'll hear more.
I mean, I thought the movie was great, definitely.
The movie was fantastic.
What's something on the list that you didn't like?
That I didn't like?
Like maybe a novel that didn't do it
for you?
You
know, also there's some stuff that I didn't, if I started and I didn't you know, I included only books that I finished.
That's good.
So, you know, it might be...
It's skewed more toward things that you actually were enjoying.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. There was this book, Beautiful Animals by Lawrence Osborne, that somebody, it's from a few years ago, somebody recommended it to me, and it was like only so-so. I mean, yeah. It was diverting enough, but I didn't love it. I mean, this, I started reading, I read one book, you know, Elizabeth Taylor, she's like a, it's the same, it's weird because it's the same name of, like,
yeah.
It's like Elizabeth Taylor, it's spelled the same, but it's like, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s, British writer.
You know, I've never heard of her.
Yeah, there's a bunch of her books. It's sort of kind of like domestic disappointments, you know, like families, like small affairs, you know, like small town intrigues. It's good. So I read one book by her called The Soul of Kindness, which I really liked. And then I got excited and I read another book by her called A View from the Harbor, which I liked less, but I made myself finish it, even though it was just less interesting. So that's one thing that I wasn't like amazing. Oh, I know. I read the Sparsholt Affair, the most recent, it's like from, I don't know, maybe 4 years ago, I think, the Allan Hollinghurst
novel.
So yeah, I think it was like, I mean, he's always good, but it wasn't amazing. I think parts of it were amazing, but I think previous books of his, like The Line of Beauty, is one of my favorite novels of all time.
What's that one about?
It's like the 80s in England, a gay kind of middle class or lower middle class protagonist who comes to London and like, or maybe, I mean, forgive me because this is, it's been many years since I read it. I remember loving it. I don't remember if it was Oxford or Cambridge. He falls into the company of the son of like a prominent Tory MP. And when he moves to London after school, they let him live in their house. And so it's this very sort of grand Thatcher era environment that he suddenly finds himself in, which is kind of while also being gay and carrying on an affair first with like a Jamaican man. And then later on with this kind of like very wealthy son of like Lebanese, like supermarket magnates. And there's AIDS that comes in and there's a lot of cocaine and a lot of, you know, sort of like 80s decadence. Yeah. There's like a sister who's kind of like suicidal and on the brink. You know, there's a lot of, it's pretty amazing. I would very much recommend it. Especially if you're interested in that era, you know, in sort of like Tory.
Yeah.
80s decadence and like, you know, gay England and, you know.
I'm sold. I'm into all of that stuff.
Yes, that should be your next book.
Thanks to Nomi for your time and generosity. This episode was recorded by me from my home in Los Angeles while Nomi was in her home in Brooklyn. It was edited and post-produced by Justin Geller in Philadelphia and facilitated by Lars Kreslins, also in Philadelphia. And the music is Bach, arranged and performed by Cyrus Garmani in Los Angeles. You can find more Apology stuff at apologymagazine.com. There are back issues of the magazine there. There is some merch, et cetera, et cetera. There are show notes for some of the episodes of the podcast. I'm a little behind on updating those now. And if you have the time and inclination, if you're enjoying the podcast, please feel free to like, subscribe, and review on whichever platform you use. It really helps. I'm told it really helps. I haven't seen proof of that yet. Okay, thank you. Talk to you next time.